Today's Tesho will be on Case 36 in the Book of Serenity, Master Ma is Unwell. Introduction. This investigating beyond mind, intellect, and consciousness. Even investigating beyond mind, intellect, and consciousness, there is still this. Even studying in ordinary and holy paths, it's already too exalted. The red-hot furnace spurts out iron barbs with tongue sword and lip spear. It's hard to open the mouth. Without running afoul of the point, please try to bring it up. Case. Master Ma was unwell. The monastery superintendent asked, "Master, how are you these days?" The great teacher said, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha." Verse. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. Stars fall, thunder rolls. The mirror faces forms without subjectivity. The pearl in a bowl rolls of itself. Don't you see, before the hammer, gold refined 100 times. Under the scissors, silk from 1 loom. Some of you have been practicing with our group for some time now. Many of you more than 5 years. In the case of many of you, more than 5 years. In the case of some people, more than 10 years. And it's always a pleasure to practice with all of you. Some of you were here last year around this time. We have been sitting in this room, we've been using this room as our zendo for 14 years. And it's always worked very well, actually. It's remarkable. It's a safe location, and generally it's quite quiet here. Last year, we sat from 7 until 10:40, and then we got up and we did kinhin, and what we did was we opened the glass doors with wedges, and then we walked outside, and we went around, there's a circle of linden trees right near this building. It's all paved, and the linden trees form a circle. And we did our kinhin walking around the circle. And I remember last year we walked out, and we were all arranged to do the kinhin, but a bird was singing so sweetly that I didn't start the walking. For like a minute or two, I just stood there and listened to that beautiful bird. I wanted everybody to have the chance to hear that beautiful bird. And then I hit the clappers and we did our kinhin. How different it is today. Today, that beautiful circle of linden trees is fenced off with orange plastic fencing. And right now, even as we speak, bulldozers and backhoes are tearing up all the cement. And also a jackhammer has been going. Fortunately, can't really hear it in here. And that's lucky for us. But They've been breaking up the cement with a jackhammer, and the backhoe and bulldozer, little bulldozer, have been picking up the pieces of cement and taking them over to these giant dumpsters. And every once in a while, if you hear something that's a little bit like thunder, it's the cement going into the dumpsters. So we couldn't do our keen-heen outside today because of that construction. And the funny thing is that, we've been sitting here all summer, and every Saturday, there hasn't been this construction on any Saturday we've been here. So this is our Saturday sit, and the day we are devoting to like a day of meditation, and somebody somewhere at Rutgers says, well, why don't we pick today to do our bust up the cement and throw it into the dumpster? If you go outside, it's usually we've been doing these Saturday sits for more than 10 years here. These all-day sits, at least once a year for more than 10 years. Usually what happens is that, we'll have lunch, and then anybody who wants to stay can stay for the rest of the day, and it's like a park out there normally, right? Hardly any students are here. You can walk around, and it's peaceful and quiet, and you can listen to the wind and the trees, but today it won't be like that. A couple times in the past, they've been having cheerleader camp on the day. Some of you might remember, they've been having cheerleader camp. So I can remember, doing keen-heen and seeing all these different groups of cheerleaders in their different colored uniforms in like clusters, And I'm surprised that they aren't doing that right now, but it must be because of the construction. But that was in times past. Cheerleader camp was our biggest disruption. It's a very mild disruption. But if you go out now, you have to be careful not to be run over by the equipment, And there's a pounding and a roaring and a grinding and a scraping. We would say that's chaos out there, chaos. Normally what we would say is, that normally we would go out and it's peaceful and quiet, and the birds are singing, and it seems like every cloud belongs in the sky just where it is, And wind blows through the trees, and it's like that's just perfect. And you might feel, and you might even think, everything is just perfect right now. It's all holding together. And how beautiful. And if you went out today, you might think, this is just like, this is a chaos, noise, grinding, scraping, banging. And this is quite unpleasant. This is disorderly. So we have in our mind that, when the day you go out and we do our keen-heen and listen to the birds, this is like the perfect order, right? And today is like disorder, like complete disorder. Just to make it even more exciting, not only is there construction outside, but today there's construction inside. And that's true, that's a first, right? So when I got up this morning and came here, it was very peaceful and quiet, and in the building, nothing was going on. And then we're about to recite our sutras, and I hear somebody out in the hallway. Or was it after the sutras? And there's a guy in the woman's room, and he's taken off the tiles of the ceiling, and he's up there, and there's another guy, and they're putting a hose, like a garden hose, up there. And I said, hello, what are you guys up to? And he said, well, we're draining the system. And I, you know, what system, you know, and we're draining the system. So anyway, you know, I said, well, are you going to, how long are you going to be? And he said, well, we just have to get this hose in there and then we're going down the hall. And I said, great, because, you know, we're using this facility today. We have like 50 people in here. And he was a little noncommittal, he said, well, you know, we were told that nobody would be here. And so anyway, Ilusha ran into these guys also as he was coming to the building, and they said, listen, we've got to get into your room, and we've got to drain the system. This is a very important, apparently very important to drain the system. And he said, we've got to get into that room. And Ilusha said, well, how long will that take? And the guy said, you know, 5 or 6 hours. Right? Now look, this has never, we've been here for 14 years. This has never happened, right? Never. In fact, you know, there's never been construction while we're having a Saturday sit. You could divide a year by, you know, 52 weeks in a year divided by 2 minus 5 for Sesshin, multiply by 14, and that's how many times it's we haven't had this problem. But today, you know, we have to drain the system. And so after the sutras, Ilusha and I walked down, and I was glad to have Ilusha with me because, you know, these are nice guys, but, you know, they're tough. And they saw that mohawk, and they knew he meant, you know, they were going to mess with him. So anyway, actually, they're very nice guys. And we talked, and they said, well, look, you know, we were told nobody would be in here. And I said, but nobody called me. Nobody called the English department and said, we're going to, you know. And he laughed. He said, that's Rutgers for you. And of course, I immediately agreed, you know, because I've been at Rutgers for 22 years. So we both shook our head, you know, with, oh, brother, you know, this is a classic Rutgers screw-up, you know. So anyway, as it turns out, they don't have to drain the system from here. We lucked out. They can drain it from the other end of the building. So if you see them, and we have to remember to thank them very much for the effort, because they're making this possible today. So if we see, I think his name was Bill, if we see Bill again, we've got to say thank you, thank you, thank you for allowing us. Because all during the, from the 8 o'clock sit until Ilusha came back at 9:30, until Ilusha reported back at 9:30 or so, I was sitting here thinking, where would we go, right? You know, how could we continue? And I was thinking, well, they might have a master key, so we could, I knew some places upstairs, like the dean's office, if we could get into the dean's office. And then I thought, well, what if the dean shows up? And she knows me, and so I don't think she'd throw us right out, you know. But there'd be some awkward moments, of course, you know. So, the dean's office was my best bet, actually. The more I thought about it, I thought, well, we could go up there. I don't know that he had a key, but there's another room on the second floor that we might be able to use. So I was thinking through how to deal with this issue, you know. And I realized, you know, it could be the case that, you know, we just couldn't go forward. You know, we might not. I mean, I thought we could go over to Murray Hall. We have a place over there. We'd all have to get in our car and drive over there. And we'd have to take all the mats and all the coolers and everything else. It would be quite an enterprise. I guess it could be done, you know. So I was thinking about that. Now, you know, it is odd, isn't it, that this would happen. You know, we sit here every other Saturday all year long. And we were here 2 weeks ago and they weren't here, you know, and 2 weeks before that. And you know, why this Saturday of all Saturdays, you know? And you could be bitter about it, or you could be, you know, you could be upset about it. But, you know, it's not just that that's not constructive, it's not awake, in my opinion. You know, this idea that that there's chaos and there's order is deeply ingrained in our way of thinking about things. And on the whole, we really like order. You know, we like order. And there's nothing wrong with that, you know. I mean, it's nice, you know, when you get up in the morning and you make a cup of tea, it's nice that you, you know, take the lid off the little container that holds the tea and put your hand in there and it's not full of, you know, bugs or something like that, you know. And when you open the cupboard, you know, the plates that were there yesterday are there today, you know, there this morning in the teacups, you know. That kind of predictability is just wonderful. And if you've ever lost your car keys, you know, you know, as I'm sure you have, it's the most frustrating thing in the world, right? You know, you think, well, I just put them down, and then you look all over the house, everywhere, and the more you can't find them, the more frustrated you become, you know. And so chaos, you know, so-called, is unpleasant, and order can be deeply reassuring. You know, there is something wonderful about, you know, getting in your car, turning on the ignition, and it starts. You know, that's wonderful. And you drive to work, and everything goes smoothly, and you get to work, and there's a parking place. This is everything, the world is really working well. You know, everything's going well. And that's wonderful. Order is beautiful, you know. And then, you know, there's chaos, right? You know, and that's where, you know, you start your car and you're on your way to work and then you get a flat tire and then you note your phone is not working, you didn't charge up your phone, you know. And then, you go into the trunk of your car and you take the spare out and the spare is flat, right, you know. And then you get to work and your boss is upset because you're late. And, you know, even if your hands have, oil on them or something, you know, nobody seems to believe your story. And then you get calls and something you did wasn't satisfactory. And by the end of the day, you know, people can feel very unhappy. This is like chaos, right? Basically, I think it's fair to say that we go through our lives trying to avoid chaos and maintain order. You know, avoid chaos and maintain order, and this is deeply a human impulse. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, people come into my office sometime, and they must just think, I mean, people must just think, you know, my office is often such a mess, you know. I've got books in boxes on the floor. I've got envelopes of various kinds on my desk. I have, papers over in this corner, and people must just think, what a mess, you know, what a chaotic mind. And every once in a while, it even gets to me, you know, and I have to clean it up. Even if I'm just taking all this stuff and putting it into piles, at the end, it feels better, you know, it feels better. I'm not sure it works any better, but at least it looks better, you know. And there's a kind of psychological feeling of security, right? Now I've got it all straightened up. You know, I feel my mind is a little clearer now for some reason, and so order, you know, order, predictability, these things are important. You know, if you think about it, we work so hard to order and structure our lives, and that's very good. You meet people whose lives are very disorderly, and they're usually not happy people, you know, actually. I've known a number of people in my life who really are, you know, profoundly disorderly in everything they do, and generally they're not happy people. My teacher, Genki Roshi, was like very orderly person, you know. So when I would go to his house, things were usually just, everything was always clean, everything was in its place. You know, Genki Roshi once corrected me because I'd thrown my sandals down. And he walked over and he picked them up and he put them very carefully together. You know, we had like a little rack for sandals. And he put them very carefully together, and he told me, you know, he said that a Zen master will often form an opinion about a monk just based upon his sandals and how he puts his sandals down. You know, careless or careful, you know. And I do indeed think there's something important about being mindful and maintaining a kind of order to things. But on the other hand, you know, I really don't believe that clinging to order and trying to avoid chaos is necessarily a good strategy. You know, I'm not convinced that there really is such a thing as order, or rather, let me put it another way, I'm not convinced there really is such a thing as chaos, you know? I really don't think there is such a thing as chaos. You know, they have a branch of science now which is the study of chaos, and there's something called chaos theory, which you may have heard of. And you know, many people don't understand what chaos theory is, you know, because they think it's saying that everything at some level is basically chaos. But actually, chaos theory is really a metaphor or a symbol for a new kind of science. And it's actually, chaos theory doesn't really deal with chaos at all. It deals with complexity. And this is, you'll read all kinds of books that will refer to chaos theory as though the world is just crazy, like a clock with all the gears gone wild, you know. But it's not like that at all. The universe is complicated, but it's actually never chaotic. See, I think that's so interesting. If you read a little chaos theory, you realize that it's not about chaos, it's about complexity. And the world is actually never really chaotic. That's what the scientists say, that it looks chaotic, but that's because we don't see the whole picture. We don't see the way it all fits together. There's a kind of, in a situation that looks like it's chaos and disorder, there could be a declining order, or there could be an emerging order, see. And I think this is actually quite helpful, because you know, actually, I think it's like that on the cushion. You know, we have to, we have to, we want things to repeat. You know. So we would like today to be like a year ago, where it was so quiet and so peaceful, and we were all alone here in this building. And that would be nice, you know. But, you know, different circumstances have emerged, and what we have now, you know, could seem like chaos. And I think when we feel that we're in the middle of chaos, we feel that we're losing control and that everything is going to hell, right? And usually our response to those kinds of events is very negative. It usually creates fear, anger, and a kind of unintelligence, you know, kind of a lack of intelligence. When we're frightened and we feel things are slipping out of control, we all have different responses. Some people get mad. You know, some people become depressed, you know, or despondent. You know, you begin to just feel helpless, maybe. And some people become resigned. You know, it's like, well, screw it, you know. And some people become, you know, cynical. But you know, there's a better way to deal with events as they're unfolding, and that is basically to assume there's a kind of order there, and that we just don't know what it is yet. And it's an emerging order or a declining order, you know. And I think much of Zen practice is actually learning how to do this, you might have been following the situation with the real estate market. About 15 years ago, my wife and I bought a house in Plainfield, and we were looking for a house that would actually be big enough to do like a sesshin. So this was the biggest house we could afford. It's not that big, but it's pretty big. It has a bathroom on every floor, and for a number of years we did sesshin there. And you know, part of my plan was that we would buy this house and fix it up, and then we would sell it someday and use the money to help build like a meditation center, you know, like a temple. And for a long time the real estate market went up, you know. So actually we paid about $155,000 for our house. And over the years, people in our neighborhood would sell their houses for larger and larger figures, you know. So, you know, we'd hear that somebody sold a house for $250,000. Wow! You know. Then you'd hear $275,000, you know, $300,000. Our next door neighbors sold their house for $500,000. It's a small house, you know. So, you know, I was sitting there thinking, you know, in my mind, the Zen Center was getting bigger and bigger and bigger, you know. Right? Great. But now it's small again, you know, because the market is crashing. And they said that yesterday in the paper, they said that, well, as you know, the real estate market has sort of crashed. And they said that it's still continuing to decline. And now two of the biggest lending agencies in the United States are going down, maybe going down. And the federal government's going to have to step in. And, you know, people must look at this with great anxiety, you know. It's possible to get very upset about this. But you know, basically, it's clear, isn't it, that this is like a moment of like a declining order. And it may decline quite a bit, you know. In other words, we might never go back to that world where there were these massively expensive houses, you know. That might not happen again, you know. And so it's painful if we hold on to the order we knew and to the, you know, to the plan that we had, and we're not necessary. That can keep us from being receptive to the order that's emerging now, right? The order that's emerging now, it could be very different. And I think that when we're resisting the order that's emerging now, we feel a lot of pain and tension and fear. But, you know, a lot of Zen practice can be understood as letting go of these expectations and these images and ideas in order to perceive the emerging order. You know, there's never chaos, you know. No matter, you know, we say it in Zen, we say everything is Buddha, or Buddha is everywhere, you know. And one way to understand that is that we're saying there's a kind of order or coherence every moment. You know, it may not be what we're looking for. You know, this is the problem with koan training. You know, people can't always answer their koan, so to speak, or work through their koan because they expect a certain kind of outcome. And they're afraid if it doesn't happen. Or maybe on an unconscious level, they're afraid. A lot of the koan, of working with the koan, is a matter of not holding on to what we expected to be the case, or what we assumed to be the case, but finding in the moment something that's present there, you know, present there, that's emerging from this moment. And you know, a lot of people find koan training very difficult because it does feel like chaos, right? You know, no matter how many koans you've answered, when you sit down in mushin, when you sit down on the cushion and your mind is blank and dark, you're really back to square one. You don't know what you're doing. You know, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what I'm doing. And that feeling can be very uncomfortable. Yes. But, you know, if you sit with the moment long enough, it's as though a pattern begins to form. You know, a pattern begins to form. There was a musician named John Cage. And John Cage started out as a fairly conventional composer, and then he became interested in musical arrangements that were not predictable. And so he began to write music that didn't seem to have any kind of pattern. And eventually, in his career, he got to the point where he would actually just put radios on a stage, you know, and turn on the radios. And when he first did this, he actually did this in France, as I understand, and people became furious. I mean, they were like throwing chairs, right? You know? Because they wanted something, they wanted a structure, you know? They wanted something predictable. Maybe they were waiting for a Beethoven, maybe they were waiting for maybe they were waiting for Debussy, right? Or maybe they were waiting for Barrés, you know, avant-garde composer they were familiar with. You know, apparently, people have to learn how to hear music. Isn't that interesting? That you become comfortable with music, but you have to learn how to hear it. So, you know, I myself, when I was younger, really loved jazz, I like big band jazz. If you know jazz, I like the big band jazz of the 30s and the 40s. But I really liked the jazz of the 60s and 70s. And I came to really love it. I love Miles Davis, I loved Weather Report. These are all old. There was a pianist named McCoy Tyner. I liked Keith Jarrett. A lot of these musicians from that period. But when I first heard it, it was hard to hear because it just seemed like chaos, right? It was just like, you know, if you've ever listened to Charlie Parker, it just sounds like. And people hear that and think, that's crap, you know, But you have to learn how to listen, you know. And what happens is that if you listen to this stuff that seems so disorderly, after a while, you begin to notice there's a kind of order in this. And of course, when that happens, you begin to be less afraid and more open, you know. But I think our tendency is, you know, when we're in a transitional mode, is to become frozen or frightened. You know, transitions are hard for everybody, you know. But the truth is that everything is transitional. You know? This is very interesting, right? Everything is transitional. It's really not the case that, it's stable and it's unchanging, and then there's transition, and then it's stable and unchanging, and then it's transition. That's how people think, but it's actually not so. You know, if you've ever seen, when I was a little kid, I don't know if they even make them anymore. There used to be these things, I can't remember what they're called, but they looked like a telescope. But then if you looked inside, you didn't see, what you saw were patterns of a colored glass, pieces of colored glass, or little bits of colored paper, different colors. And there were multiple mirrors in the tube. And so as you twist it, it would make designs like snowflake designs, you know, or all kinds of interesting fractal forms, you know. And you turn this thing and it would just keep going and going. And as these little bits of color would shift, it would make a kaleidoscope. The kaleidoscope would produce these beautiful forms, and as you turned it, one form would turn into another form. You know, it's never actually not a form. You know, or you could, you know, it's never actually not. There's, you know, physicists say that what we call the laws of nature didn't always exist. I think that's quite interesting. So for example, they think that early in the history of the universe, the laws of physics might have been somewhat different from what they are now. Isn't that interesting? And they think that there are other universes that have different laws of physics. So, you know, even the laws of nature are changing. Isn't that interesting? I was reading this article about primates. And it said that actually, you know, if you look at chimpanzees in different places, they can behave very, very differently. You know, so if you study this group of chimpanzees, you might reach this conclusion about chimpanzee behavior. But if you go over here and you study another group, they may organize themselves very differently. You know, and actually this person also said that over time they change, you know. So, I think it's very important to trust, you know, to trust as things unfold, I think trust is very important. I think part of Zen practice is learning how to trust. You know, when you first have a koan, it's so difficult to work through because you don't know what you're doing, right? You know, you sit on the cushion and, you know, you're able to get into a blank state, and you're repeating your cushion, repeating your koan rather. And you might say your koan over and over and over again, and, you know, the more you go on, the more frustrating it could become, you know, because you're waiting, and maybe you've been practicing, you've been doing this koan for months, maybe even years, you know, and you feel the pressure. And, you know, you can get mad, you can feel despair, but eventually, if you keep practicing Zen, you just sort of give up, and you wait for something to present itself. And that experience of waiting for something, sort of quietly, patiently waiting to see what's going to arise, I think is a very healthy mindset. You know, you learn how to trust. You learn how to trust. Something is arising here. I don't know what it is. You know, and if you can maintain a balanced, calm mind, and if you don't hold on to things, if you don't grasp at concepts, or you don't grasp at the desire for a result, you know, something can emerge in the moment that's really quite different from what you expected, and it's really alive, you know. So I think Zen people learn how to tolerate uncertainty. It's not easy. I mean, I think humans love certainty. We like to have everything predictable, knowable, and of course that's good, not bad. You know, that's part of life. But if you cling too rigidly, you can become frozen and fearful and tense, you know, angry, whatever. There's a kind of order in every moment that's emerging. And what you need to do is try to stay open long enough to encounter it and then to harmonize yourself with it. This is a really central part of Zen practice, harmonizing yourself with this implicit emerging order. You know? And people who do this, I think, have great joy and energy and real fearlessness, you know, real fearlessness and also never discouraged, you know. It's so easy. In my life, I've been so discouraged when I was young. I was easily discouraged, you know. And the older I get and the more I do Zazen, the less discouraged I get by things, you know. I've been working to get this day of sitting ready for a number of days, you know. So, for example, I didn't really have any bowls. You know, we didn't have enough bowls. So I bought some more bowls, and I bought them at an Asian grocery store. And I had to clean them off. I had to take all the labels off, right? You might know that if you try to get those labels off, they're gummy and sticky, and it takes time. Sometimes you have to use lighter fluid or something to take them off. And then you have to wash all the bowls, and then, you know, put them in boxes and put them in the car and take them here. And that was one task. And then I had to, you know, I thought we needed some things to eat for the retreat, the day of sitting. So I made lentils for lunch and chickpeas for dinner. And I got up and I did those things. And then I had to get other things, handkerchiefs and so on. And then I had to get the coolers out of the attic, the ice chests. And I put these things in the ice chest, and then I drove on the way here. I drove to ShopRite and got ice. All of this is very time consuming. I'm not telling you this to impress you. But what would happen if the guys had to drain the system? See? And I've spent like really a lot of time on this project. You know, it's possible to get discouraged and say, "Oh, this is so unfair." You know, this is really unpleasant, you know. I've worked so hard and now it's all for nothing, right? All for nothing. Phew, life, what a bummer, you know. But I think that's the shallow experience of life, right? You know, it could easily have happened that the guy couldn't have drained the system. And, you know, maybe at 12, we might be having this Teisho outside in the grass right now, you know? And at 12 noon, we might just have to say, okay, today we're not going to do this. But I assure you, I wouldn't have been discouraged. You know, I really wouldn't. I really wouldn't. I think when people feel discouraged, it's because we are living in our small selves. You know, I'm always amazed at somebody. You know, so often in the history of Buddhism, you know, there have been significant like defeats. You know, in India, not everybody liked Buddhists. You know, might come as a shock. But Buddhists were challengers of things like the caste system. And actually, Buddhism has a long history, even though people don't realize this. You know, Buddhism in India had a long history of providing women with the opportunity for education and independence. And the first university in the world was Nalanda University, and it admitted women long before there was even an Oxford. But the point was, you know, Buddhists had enemies in India. And over 1,000 years, the enemies decided this is how we'll get rid of Buddhism. And they did. And then there were some foreign invasions that finished it off. You know? And I always think, you know, the monks who were around there at the end of that could have gotten so discouraged. They could have gone, well, you know, this is so unfair. You know, this is, look, ruin, you know. Our monasteries are being sabotaged. You know, people are making fun of us, belittling us. These foreign invaders have wrecked our great universities. You know, we should just throw in the towel. But that's not what they did. You know, it's fascinating to me. You know, they went to India. I mean, they went to Tibet. They went to China. They continued to practice. Apparently, there was this terrible invasion they actually have a historical record of this, but northern India was the heartland of Buddhism. And these invaders from the West came and pretty much destroyed it all. And they wrecked the great Buddhist university, Nalanda University. And there's a historical record that this Chinese man came and he said, I went to Nalanda and it was totally wrecked, but you know what? There was one monk there and he was still teaching people in the ruins, right? And I can't remember his name, but they know his name. I just think that's amazing. You know, this Chinese monk said, you know, this monk, this Indian monk is still there. He's still teaching people how to meditate, you know, and achieve liberation, you know. And he did that until he died, you know. And I just think that kind of determination, that kind of energy, you know, that doesn't come from circumstances. See, you know, if you say, I'll feel happy today if it's sunny, but I'll be sad if it's rainy. That's you're depending on circumstances, right? You know, or you could say, I'll be happy if so-and-so likes me, and if so-and-so doesn't like me, I'll be sad. That's, you know, that's, I think that's very shallow, personally. You know, people who are in touch with their true nature, who harmonize themselves with the Tao, have indestructible commitment, right? Indestructible. And that because it's like the energy you're drawing, you're connected to the energy of the whole universe, which can't be destroyed. You know, the universe can't be destroyed. You can destroy all the Buddhist monasteries in India, but you can't destroy reality. You can't destroy the universe. So I think this must have been sort of what this monk understood, you know, not in his discriminating mind, but with his whole being. And those people just took their robes and put them over their shoulders and walked to Tibet and walked to China, you know. Indestructible energy, and of course, the whole time, you know, I would like to think they were, you know, free. They worked very hard to be free from the slightest bit of hatred or resentment. You know, that's not awake either. So, Master Ma was unwell. You know, sometimes we're sick and sometimes we're healthy. But actually, there's no such thing as sickness. You know, really, no such thing as disorder. You know, there's something is always emerging. You know, it's a different form, but it's always a form. Master Ma was unwell, and actually, he died shortly after this. The monastery superintendent asked, "Master, how is your venerable self these days? How are you these days?" And the great teacher said, sun face Buddha, moon face Buddha. I said, oh, there's no such thing as chaos. What's the order now? What's arising now? See. And if you have, if you know how to be open to the moment, you know, if you can be open, you have like indestructible resolve, you know. The Bodhisattva vow is to, you know, even if it takes a million lifetimes, I will keep coming back to help people until even the grass is enlightened, right? And of course, being reborn, that sounds easy, but reborn in like, you know, terrible worlds, you know, terrible situations. But, you know, that indestructible vow, that indestructible commitment comes from this kind of openness. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. Stars fall, thunder rolls. This is the unfolding of the universe. Yeah? The mirror faces forms without subjectivity. It's our small self that makes us afraid of the unfolding of the universe, right? You know, if you are like an empty mirror, if you're an empty mirror, you can embrace whatever is unfolding in front of you, right? Reflecting whatever is unfolding in front of you. The pearl in a bowl rolls by itself. Don't you see? Before the hammer, gold refined 100 times. Under the silk, scissors from one loom. So we had this beautiful opportunity to practice today with the bulldozers and the jackhammers and everything else. You know? And you know what? In 3 months or 4 months, it's going to be beautiful out there again. And it's like a new order arising, right? And it's always the case, right? Always the case. This is what it means to be alive. This is living universe. So thank you.